Chris, thank you very much for those fabulous remarks. As the cards are coming up, I want to do a little advertising. In the back of the room, and then later on, if they're not all sold out, down at the bookstore downtown, there's Outpost, a diplomat at work, where you can get 25 years of this experience, not just one set. But I picked it up today. I know what I'll be doing on my next couple of trips.
By the way, Ken, I think writing a book is one of the most shameless businesses one can do. But I do want to make the advertisement. I wrote every word of that book. And I did use spell check. But
hopefully you use an editor now and then, too.
But I wrote it all.
Fabulous. Thank you. Well, you opened it up with, I think, the question that everybody has on their mind. In the last 3 weeks, we've had a challenging G7. We've had a difficult NATO meeting. And today we had an interesting session. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah. When the administration started, I thought, every administration goes through a learning curve. And I thought that given the fact that our president has not had government service or military service, I'll stop there, that this would be a steeper learning curve than some of the others. I think I was way too optimistic. And I think what we're seeing, what we saw in the treatment of our allies, which actually started with Justin Trudeau and has continued throughout, is a president who, whatever one thinks of his personal attributes, he has not understood the meaning of the fact that he serves the state. And when you serve the state, you can have personal opinions. I mean, believe me, if you had invited me 10 years ago, I wouldn't have said a tenth of what I said today, because you represent the state, and you have to understand that there are issues that are, that represent U.S. government policy, and you have to be respectful of what U.S. government policy is. And you don't say, the state, that's me, and I'll just make my own policy. And so I think to some extent the president has not come to grips with the fact that he's the chief executive. And as such, he has to manage others' opinions and sometimes different opinions. I can remember George W. Bush. I wanted him to raise some aircraft issue. We were trying to sell F-16s to Poland. And I said, I really want you to raise the issue of selling F-16s to Poland, which, by the way, were made in Fort Worth, Texas. And he said, you really want me to mention airplanes at this summit meeting with the Polish president? And he didn't want to have to do that, and he felt it looked bad because he's talking about planes that are essentially fabricated in his own state, and he kind of felt that was the wrong thing to do. A number of people, including Secretary Rice, made the point that, look, we are up against competition, and they press for their planes. And besides that, we want Poland to have NATO an American plane so they can fly with us. And that is part of why we have allies, so that we can fight side by side. And the president did it, even though it was completely contrary to his instincts. I think President Trump needs to be more respectful when people come up and say, you got to do this. He may not like it, but he needs to understand that we have policies, we have a government where people have thought these things through. And so I think what we've seen in the last few weeks is a president who's become, it's gotten worse, and he's become a little less tethered than before. And I'm afraid it's not going to get better until some other people step up and show some guts and be prepared to say, no, that's wrong. I'm sorry to riff on about this, but it drives me crazy. A few years ago, I was I can't remember what job it was, but I had lunch with someone who was deeply tied to Poland, someone named Zbigniew Brzezinski. And Brzezinski, I had known him since I was Polish desk officer, and he'd very kindly see the Polish desk officer, saw me, saw my predecessor, saw my successor. And he said, "Chris, congratulations on this new job, but I hope you understand that these jobs are all temporary, and that whether you serve in the job for 2 years, 3 years, even 4 years, you'll go back to normal life. I mean, this is coming from a very wise man, Dr. Brzezinski." And he said, "So the issue is you have to think of these jobs as platforms for things you want to do, you want to accomplish, and you want to get done. And if you start worrying, well, if I say this thing, then I won't get to the next job, you're probably not going to get anything done. And so what you really need to do is be prepared to step down whenever you feel you have to, because sooner or later you're going to leave anyway. So do it on your terms and do it because you've stood up and made the right point."
Great, thank you. I want to combine a couple in the context of what does security future look like on the peninsula, right? So negotiating to a future scenario. There's on the one hand the North Korean insistence that U.S. troops come out.
Yeah.
That obviously is disconcerting to the South Koreans. But on the other hand, there's the question of what provides protection for the North Koreans if they give up their weapons.
Right.
Do you see a way to put the thread through that needle hole?
You know, that's why these issues don't get solved in a 45-minute meeting. But certainly, over the years, we have told the South Koreans, you do not need a nuclear weapon. By the way, not every South Korean has agreed with that proposition. But we've told them over the years, you don't need a nuclear weapon because we have something called the nuclear umbrella. And an attack on you is an attack on all. And so we are there for you. And so we make clear that our nuclear umbrella extends to South Korea. The issue you're asking is, does North Korea get a nuclear umbrella? And I bet that in the context of kind of a negotiation with the regional players there, whether that's China, Russia, US, Japan, I am convinced we can work out something that functions in those terms. If North Korea does get to the point where they give up their nuclear weapons, first of all, we have to stand up for what we agreed to, and the successor to whoever makes the agreement can't just walk out on it. And of course, I have in mind another agreement in another part of the world, Iran. And I think as a country, we need to stop personalizing these issues and understand when the president makes a decision, you don't just undo that decision on the next with the next president. So now, whether we can get to the point where agreements are then ratified, they're called treaties and ratified by 2/3 of the Senate, beautiful. If that can be done, they should do that. But I think if we can create a situation where people believe that this agreement holds through our elections, if we can create a situation where everyone thinks this will hold through the second, Sarah Palin administration, I think that's the kind of situation we want to have, that they can believe us. And then finally, with respect to if they're denuclearized, we can then look at various non-nuclear, sort of mutually balanced force reductions, confidence-building measures. I can imagine they pull back troops from the 30th parallel. We could pull back troops from the 30th parallel. I'm sure we could take some measures, but it has to be done in the context of denuclearization.
Good, thank you. You sort of spoke to it. In North Korea, the state is the regime. The regime is the family, sort of, and it's definitely the leader. What can you tell us about Kim Jong-un that provides insight into the big switch over the last months in his personality, in his approach to the outside world?
Yeah, I don't think people make those big switches. And so I think we have to ask the question, were we right about him before? and are we right about him today? I think for Kim Jong-un, to understand how he thinks, I've talked to North Korean defectors, including the guy who defected from their embassy in London, and he in particular said, this is not about you Americans, it's not even about South Korea, it's about his competition with his deceased father and his deceased grandfather. And what you have to understand is when Kim Jong-un talks about unifying the peninsula, it's in effect a criticism of his grandfather for failing to do that. Or when he talks about the need for North Korea as a nuclear state, it's a criticism of his father for failing to complete the task. So I think that is still where his mentality is. And I think he has reason to believe that somehow we will accept some residual nuclear force in North Korea. And that's essentially why he's had this change of heart. But I don't think it's a change of heart based on the zero option of doing away with his nuclear weapons. And I think that process, which as I laid out a few minutes ago, I think is we can convince people that they have better life without nuclear weapons than with them. But we have to be very clear about it and very prepared to follow through on it and to keep coming after them until they really see the truth in it. And so I don't think we have a changed Kim Jong-un, but we do have a changed climate in which our president is absolutely invested in success here. But I mean, to be successful is to, I think, press even harder on what they were calling maximum pressure. So.
Given the statements, I think, about ending the exercises for the moment that surprised everybody in the administration, yeah. including Secretary Mattis, who yeah. then went off with Pompeo to say some things, what's your sense of where the military relations with South Korea are, and what do you think about exercises in the future?
Yeah. I think South Korea is a like many countries, perhaps including our own, as a deeply divided society today. I think Moon Jae-in, who is the president and head of their Progressive Party, and by the way, to understand South Korean politics, the left in South Korea, they tend to be the sort of anti-foreigners and the supporters of closer relationship with North Korea. It's the right that tends to be pro-foreign and in favor of a tougher relationship with North Korea. So I think they have a deeply divided split. I think the right, if you will, lost because, frankly, Park Geun-hye, the last president, she's in prison today on conviction charges for some corruption, which did not redound to her, but whatever the past of redoubt is, to her friends. And so I think that really hurt the right, but I think they could be back depending on the economy next election. I think what to understand the Korean military, however, is to understand a military that deeply appreciates the relationship with the United States, understands it's important, understands how the relationship with the United States has really been a force multiplier for Korea's influence in the world. I think there are a lot of people in Korea who understand that. And so I don't look to see any lasting changes in our relationship coming from the Korean side. I'm more worried coming from this side, because if Americans cannot be explained why we have troops in country X, what we're doing, I think sooner or later there will be pressure to remove those troops from country X. And so I think it behooves anyone who believes it not to do this sort of, we have them because we need them, you know, this sort of mansplaining that goes on over the years. I think there needs to be a much more comprehensive effort to lay it out for the American people and understand why this is a damn good investment. And by the way, a lot of our expenses in South Korea are paid for by the South Koreans, such that there's no big benefit to bringing those troops to Fort Hood in Texas.
China. You mentioned that obviously China, as part of a framework, has to be part of this. What should our policy toward China with respect to North Korea be, and how in particular do you deconflict individual policy proposals as you approach a strategy like a China relationship?
There is no question that China over the years has stolen our intellectual property rights. There's no question that they have taken advantage of us in trade terms. There's no question that for this trading relationship with China to be sustainable, things needed to change. So as a sort of a proposition, I think that's a fact. The problem I have with it and with a lot of things today is how it's being done and whether it's being done in a way to maximize our interests elsewhere. And I think this so-called trade war with China is a very big mistake. And I am not suggesting we should ignore what they have done on intellectual property rights over the years. And I'm not suggesting that we should somehow have business as usual with China, because no country can sustain these kinds of deficits. But I think we also need to understand that if we need China's help in a question like North Korea, we need to have a serious discussion with the Chinese, and we have to have a serious discussion that is not crowded out by trade issues, and that's kind of what we're getting right now. China has worried about North Korea's demise. They know it's brittle. You know, usually very strong totalitarian societies are strangely weak. And so I think China's understood that. So why are they worried about North Korea? They're, you know, American newspapers used to always talk about, oh, they're worried about North Korean refugees. China's 1.4 billion. There are 22 million North Koreans. Even if the last North Korean, you know, shut off the lights and came into China, I don't think that's the issue. I think it's far more complex. One, for all of China talking about, they always, you know, we hear this from Xi Jinping, and they always want win-win. They don't know what win-win is. They think it's a, you know, Burmese dissident or something. What they really, see is if North Korea is taken over by South Korea, that's a win for America and a defeat and a loss for China. And I think they worry very much how that would look. It's not that their system has anything to do with the North Korean system. It doesn't. But the perception is that was their part of the Korean Peninsula, and we have our part, and our part wins. That looks bad for them. So I think that goes on. And I think also the situation, you know, China's complex. I know Xi Jinping has been amassing a lot of power. There's a lot of concern with the abolition of the limited term. A lot of concerns about how he's managing things. But I think we also need to understand that that's a big country with a lot of churn politically. And so if the neighboring Marxist-Leninist state goes down, how does that affect the domestic debate within China? Now, for many Americans, we just say, beats the heck out of me, we'll see what happens. That's not a good enough answer for people who went through the Cultural Revolution and who know the problem of ideological struggle within China and what it has meant in terms of China's history. So all this argues, in my view, for a sophisticated approach to the Chinese, to sit down with them, to kind of lay out what we're going to do, why we're going to do it, to listen to their point of view, make adjustments as we need to. I remember sitting with George W. Bush in a meeting in Australia during one of these international meetings, and Hu Jintao, this Chinese Secretary General who, if he ever had charisma, it cleared up a long time ago, I tell you. And so President Bush is sitting with him, and he said, Mr. President, referring to Hu Jintao, he said, I just want to let you know I'm going to have the Dalai Lama at the house. I'm going to meet him in the family quarters, so it won't be an official meeting. I just want you to know I don't want any surprises between us. I want it clear to you, though, that it's important to some of our people that I have the Dalai Lama at the White House, but not to worry, it'll be in the family quarters. And so Hu Jintao was kind of shocked. He's looking around for his notes. And then President Bush says, you know, I know this is tough. I know you don't agree with what I'm doing, but I have to do it. And he kind of lays it out. And ultimately, the Chinese, okay, we got it. And President Bush was true to his word, too. He didn't make any big political thing. He didn't talk about independence for Tibet. He didn't go into Taiwan and these kinds of questions. He was respectful of what the Chinese say are their core interests, but he kind of laid this stuff out and explained what our thinking is. We need to have more of these kinds of discussions with the Chinese. And the trouble is today, you know, with this trade issue, I mean, every time we talk to them, you know, it becomes sort of a Christmas tree of issues, you know, don't forget cars, don't forget this or that. And before you know it, you're kind of bogged down and you don't really make the progress with China. Look, I think North Korea will eventually be resolved, I think. And I think when we look back and see how we resolved it, it will be resolved because we had a good working relationship with China, not a bad working relationship.
Great. One last question to the notion of clarity of discussion, and in particular in reference to the Wizard of Oz and Behind the Curtain. You know, how representative is what the general public learns about how work gets done in Washington and elsewhere? They get it increasingly in segmentation of media and in articles where opinion and news are blurred. But, you know, from your perspective, how much do people get to learn about what is actually happening behind the curtain?
It's a very important question. You know, and it's not a question of right or left in this country. I mean, I read, you know, newspaper editorials from, you know, national newspapers associated with liberalism, and it's usually stuff like, you know, the U.S. government needs to tell those people this or that, you know. Well, you know, try going into a room where you're trying to get someone to come around on the other, to another point of view, and you're just kind of hitting them, you know, very hard on these things. And they, at a certain point, they kind of tune out. You know, you've got to be willing, you know, even in that example I gave of the Dalai Lama, the president asked, I mean, he talked to him. He said, look, this is what I want to do, because, you know, and they got it. I mean, and I think there needs to be, you know, we're a country, you know, you ask many people abroad, you know, what do you think of Americans? And, you know, and, you know, traditionally, you wouldn't have people answering, well, Americans are extremely ideological and you can't do business with them. That would not have been the answer in the past. It was sort of, Americans haven't been so involved with the history that they carry grudges forever. Americans actually have a kind of ingenuity to them, and they try to get stuff done, and they're really in favor of kind of moving forward on issues. That would be kind of our reputation, a sort of, you know, we put together a lot of things on the fly, but we're sort of a MacGyver nation. You know, okay, how do we solve that? Where's my Swiss Army knife? And you know, that, I think, has traditionally been our role. We're not ideological, but I think this, you know, I'm all in favor of democracy, and don't get me wrong for a minute here, but you know, it's not a secular religion either. And I think, to me, it's the far and away the best way to protect human values, including human rights, and I recommend it for everybody. But for us to be going around smacking places that somehow didn't get it the first time, or trying to introduce it with the tip of a bayonet, it doesn't work. I mean, like a lot of things in life, it has to be accepted by the recipient of the message. And so I think to some extent, our country needs to calm down a little. You know, this, I think one of the biggest problems is this kind of notion we have as victims. You know, I mean, for most of the world, when they look at America, they don't think of us as, you know, victims. But for many Americans, you know, well, we're tired of people pushing us around and running up their trade surpluses with us, and we just can't, you know, on and on about, you know, that we're somehow the most aggrieved country in the world. And, you know, there's this, so what's that country western song, I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. At least you know you're free? I mean, how about the biggest houses in the world, the best income in the world? I mean, what's the matter? Why do you say at least? There are a lot of great things about this country. And so to some extent, it's going to involve a kind of regaining of our self-confidence. And we need that, because I think a lot of it is lacking. We lack in self-confidence. And we also, I think we have the best model. We sometimes make mistakes, but I think we have the best model, and let people come to that view rather than go around yelling at them until they get so sick of us they say, sure, sure, we accept. They don't really accept. So I think we just need to calm down a little, talk to each other a little more, be a little more tolerant, even when we have screwy ideas about things. I mean, I used to think it was, with everyone in America having a baseball team, we kind of kept this sort of ethnic strife confined to, Yankees versus Red Sox. And unfortunately, baseball is in demise, so I guess the problem is we're sounding like other countries in terms of our divisions. So we got to get over it and get serious and understand that, the best way to persuade someone is just that, and have that person say, you make a good point. Let me give it some thought. I think I'm coming around to it, rather than to yell at them and tell them you'll never talk to them again. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.